Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I'm Johnny B. Good, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances. Whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions change their careers, what relationships influenced their work. My guest today is Antonia Yuhas, a journalist and activist, who wrote an article in the June issue of Harper's Magazine about the 2010 BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The article is more than an investigation into that monumental disaster. It's a highlight in a career dedicated to investigating the oil industry. For the past 15 years, Yuhas has been following oil, the companies that are entrusted with it, the executives who make the decisions about it, and the workers who get the oil out of the ground.
People who work within the oil industry are lifers. They start out young. They work their way up through the company. Most of the heads of these companies are people who spent their entire lifetimes within the same companies. And they believe that they are doing the dirty, hard work that someone has to do. Someone has to go out there and go through the muck and go through the mud and do the harm and do all the things that need to happen so that we can drive our lovely cars, and right, they're the ones who are doing it. They also make a lot of money. And from the perspective of working their companies, they're doing a great job. ExxonMobil is the most profitable corporation the world has ever known, over and over and over and over again. So if you work in ExxonMobil, you're saying, one, I'm doing the hard, tough work that no one else wants to do, and two, I'm making more money than any company has ever made in the history of the world, so how can you possibly tell me I'm doing a bad job?
It's a win-win for everybody.
So when you ask them, you know, when you think about the what about, you know, the fact that the United Nations says that 80% of fossil fuels have to stay in the ground if we're going to avert the worst of climate crisis, you know, what are you doing as a company? What they say is, while we're dependent on oil and fossil fuels, and we are, you need us to do our job. And then sometimes they say—
You don't want to get caught up short.
You don't want to get caught up short. And then sometimes they say, if you watch their commercials, and we are doing the right thing. Look at all the money we're spending on solar and wind, and look at all the money we spend on human rights. And, you know, Chevron has commercials all the time.
What are they spending on solar and wind?
So I did an investigation of this because, you know, this is their claim.
I'm so happy you said that. And?
And I did a piece for this in Rolling Stone. And, you know, the truth is that the oil industry has been dramatically moving its way out of alternative energy investments, if it ever really was invested. The best company was at best, very generously, 4% of total of their total expenditures, and that was BP at its height. And I think that was 2008, but I don't have the year memorized. And that was the best. So the other companies were 0.2%, 0.1%. Exxon basically never even pretended to invest in alternative energy and really hasn't. And a lot of that money was actually in biofuels, not even in, you know, wind or solar. But now the companies have all—
Like ethanol.
like
do they count that?
Yeah, they count that.
Yeah,
right.
They count ethanol.
They count ethanol. So, you know, and all the problems attendant with that. But they basically removed themselves from those sectors as well. So now it's almost nothing. And actually, even speaking of ethanol, BP, which has now almost completely divested from solar and wind, announced the closing of facilities in Louisiana and in San Diego for making cellulosic biofuels. So they're even now moving out of the biofuel sector, which is, you know, probably good. And actually, from my perspective, to be honest, you know, oil is a natural resource, just like the sun and the wind. There are places like the bottom of the ocean where naturally releasing oil actually lives over, you know, thousands of years in harmony with the environment. What this industry has done is taken a natural resource and turned it into a weapon of mass destruction. So I say, do we really want them to now, because they've done such a bang-up job with oil, do we really want to give them the wind and the sun? Do we really want them doing alternative energy? So my answer is no. And what I would rather say is they haven't done a bang-up job with the resource they've been given. So while we are dependent on their resource, they could do a much, much, much better job of providing it in ways that are much more environmentally and socially and economically beneficial.
The 2010 explosion aboard the Deepwater Horizon oil rig killed 11 people and led to a powerful seafloor oil gusher that lasted 87 days. According to the on-scene coordinator report, over 200 million gallons of oil leaked into the Gulf of Mexico. Antonia Yuhas investigated the multiple causes of the disaster later, but on that first day, April 20th, 2010, she was far away.
April 2010, and I was in San Francisco following oil in the same way that I do, and I saw sort of a blip come across the screen about an explosion in the Gulf of Mexico. And honestly, at first, it didn't ring a lot of bells because, in fact, there's a lot of offshore oil spills, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico. They happen fairly routinely. We don't necessarily pay a lot of attention to them. And there weren't any pictures or anything yet. You know, this is very far out.
But when you say offshore oil spills that are routine yeah. means they don't blow up and there's a lot of flames billowing.
Yeah, but we didn't know that. So, you know, at first...
So the more routine ones don't involve explosions and flames.
Right. Not
the water, just something erupts and oil goes into the water.
Oil spills happen often. Small explosions happen often. So there are... And there is, you know, a lot of problems that happen with rigs out in the Gulf. As the days unfolded, though, it became clearer and clearer that this was a significant incident, much larger than I had originally thought. And what seemed also clear as the days were moving on was that it wasn't something that was going to be stopped anytime soon. So I was actually contacted by The Guardian to do a piece looking mostly at, because I still didn't have a lot of information. It's still early on. You know, now I know why there wasn't information, but at the time I just assumed, you know, we're just sort of learning a little bit at a time because it's not necessarily that big of a deal. I get contacted by The Guardian to do a piece, and the piece is mostly focusing on, is it a surprise that it's BP? So, you know, this happens to a company. Is it a surprise that BP
question?
Is the company? Because BP had just been through the Texas City refinery disaster, which was prior to this, one of the worst workplace disasters in U.S. history in the oil sector, 15 refinery workers dead, 150 injured. The Alaska pipeline spill had happened, which was a BP pipeline.
Not a good time for BP.
Not a good time for BP. And Tony Hayward, who was the CEO at the time, had also been, and had been for many years, facing takeover rumors. And one of the reasons for the takeover rumors, which continue to this day, was that BP had a very low reserve replacement ratio, which means that it wasn't replacing oil at the same speed that it was producing it and getting it out of the ground. And that makes it a weak company. So he was being very adventurous in pursuing
oil. When you say replacing, what do you mean? Describe
finding
that
new,
cycle.
Finding new fields,
new finds,
and being able to book them, which means that you can prove that you can actually
proven
produce
fields.
The oil.
Right.
Exactly.
So as you're taking oil or extracting oil out of the ground, you want to know there's more out there that's yours.
Exactly. Exactly.
And ready to go.
And investors want to know that there's more out
there
that you
go.
Can replace.
Right.
And so he was extremely adventurous and also seemed to be more willing than others to put time and money and profit ahead of other concerns. So when I was first looking at this incident, I said, it's not a surprise that it's BP. But then, and so that was the first, sort of look that I, the first look was just the company. Then it kept unfolding. And so then by May, I went down to the Gulf Coast and did a tour of the Gulf Coast and started interviewing people, fishermen and fisher folks, started interviewing elected officials, started to, really try and suss out what's unfolding here. And then that made it increasingly clear, because at this point, the spill is now 20 days in. It's not ending anytime soon. It doesn't look like it's ending anytime soon. That not only is this a serious disaster, but there is a huge untold story here of why it happened, what if anything is going to be able to solve the problem, and what if anything is going to be changed in the future. And at that point, I decided to write a book. And I'm like, this is what I'm going to need to do. It's an article isn't going to do it. This can't be a short one-off. Yeah. And I—
A lot of surface area here.
Yeah, and there's just way too much. There's just way too much going on. Way too many unknowns. And so I begin the process of writing a book and continue to write articles at the same time. But the book is Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. And that came out in 2011. And I continued while still covering other issues, including traveling to Afghanistan to cover the role of oil and gas in the war in Afghanistan and other things.
Now, when does Atlantis, Alvin, the stuff that's in the Harper's article, when does that enter your windshield?
So one of the first people I contact to find out what is the significance of this oil spill, which ultimately becomes the largest offshore oil spill in world history, is Dr. Samantha Joy, a biogeochemist at the University of Georgia, who everyone tells me from the very beginning is the person to talk to about oil and gas in the Gulf of Mexico.
Why?
Because she is the person who has done the most investigations in the field, trying to just understand—
Honest investigations. She's not a patsy for the oil company.
Oh, not at all.
So you meet her.
I meet her. I start interviewing her right away.
Had she been in the Alvin before?
So she's the only person to have led a previous Alvin mission to the site of the oil spill after the oil spill.
When did she go?
So she went in December 2010.
That year. Right. So just for people who are listening, the Atlantis is the ship and the Alvin is— and now who owns the ship? The U.S. Navy?
Or
Woods Hole?
The Navy owns this fleet of scientific research vessels. It's a ship,
so it's
and the
property,
Alvin, the
right.
submarine.
And the Alvin, which is the submersible they own.
Exactly.
And where does Woods Hole come in?
Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution manages all of the above.
They're like a subcontractor.
And the Alvin submarine is the only human-occupied research submarine that exists in the United States anymore. It was the first, and now it's the last. It's been around for 50 years. It explored the Titanic. It found a nuke that got lost in the ocean.
Yeah, the hydrogen bomb.
So, you know,
whose hydrogen bomb was it?
I can't remember.
I'm gonna look that up. Anyway, go ahead.
But it was lost, and they found it.
So she booked that trip for you, and you went out when?
So Alvin goes under $40 million worth of refurbishing. It finally gets to go out again. And when she finds out that she's going to get to do the first mission back to the site of the BP oil spill, she wants there to be a journalist with her. And she lets me know that I get to be the one. to say the least. I was both elated and scared. Yes.
Say, what if this thing blows a rivet while I'm down there? They just refurbished it.
Well, yeah,
great.
And it turns out—
Let me see that bill for that refurbishing of the Alvin.
Exactly.
Somehow the refurbishing did not include restroom facilities. Those in need were forced to use a bottle. You can listen to earlier episodes of Here's the Thing by visiting our archives, like my conversation with Dr. Robert Lustig, who talked to me about the growing obesity pandemic and its link to a very different energy source.
And we've learned that the higher your insulin goes, the hungrier you get.
The hungrier you are. So, sugar is an appetite stimulant.
In a sense,
accelerant,
yes.
Whatever you want to call it.
You can call it that.
Right.
Absolutely.
Take a listen at heresthething.org.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day. Because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. To better understand the impact of the 2010 BP oil spill, Antonia Yuhas joined biogeochemist Samantha Joy last year in a submersible that traveled over 5,000 feet down to reach the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico.
It took 2 hours to get down. The total trip in the Alvin was 8, so 5 hours on the bottom.
So you were 5 hours down there with her.
Yeah.
You'd been there before.
Yes.
What did she say to you?
She said, you know, the first time she went down, there was nothing. All the sea life that could get away from the oil got away from the oil, and everything that couldn't, in her words, was nuked. Yeah. It just got pummeled. We come back down.
Refugee sea life.
Right. And basically what I see is a moonscape. There's basically nothing down there.
Which was not normal.
No. I mean, normally you would see coral, sea fans, fish, even sharks and whales.
Abundant
inhibit.
Flora and fauna, if you will.
You know, it's not like an underwater Amazon. This is
sure.
The deep, dark
it's
bottom.
Disneyland.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, there would have been a lot more life. There should have been a lot more life.
There's nothing.
So what we saw is a little bit of a change. So there was the occasional sea life that came through. And so that was positive. There were giant isopods, which are basically foot-long cockroaches. That was exciting to see float by. I saw a couple of those.
No, wait a second. It's a fish that resembles a cockroach?
It is an underwater cockroach. It's called an isopod.
Really?
Yeah. Who knew they existed? And I'm not entirely sure
and
that I'm happy to know that they
always
existed.
Say cockroaches are going to survive.
Exactly.
Everything.
So the giant cockroaches survived. We also saw, which was amazing, one vampire squid, which is this long squid that has a red head. And it went zooming by, and that thrilled Dr. Joy because those are incredibly rare to see. We saw the occasional eel, an occasional crab, a little teeny like blue and pink fish, but mostly it was nothing. I mean, this was the occasional occurrence. And
maybe something that had wandered in there accidentally.
They just like sort of made their way, you know, in. What we should have seen, a lot more. But what is not good is that what was also out there is 3,000 miles worth of oil.
Right. I want to nail these facts down for people.
Yeah.
Did you say it was an inch or two thick, the bed?
At most, at its greatest depths, it's 2 inches thick.
So at its greatest depths, this carpet
of oil.
Of oil near the site is 3,000 square miles, 60 miles by, or whatever, whether it's shaped like an American flag or—
It's the size of Delaware and Rhode Island combined.
Right.
So this isn't just around the site. This is a huge carpet of oil that has been there for 4 years.
Now, I want to ask you a couple of questions based on that.
So
there's a lot of myth-making here and an urban legend, if you will.
The myth that got circulated was that all the oil was gone because the bugs ate it, right? That's
or we're
was
going
circulated,
to eat it.
Or we're going to eat it. And that was well circulated. It was circulated by a scientist who was funded by BP to come up with that information.
Who is that scientist?
I should know his name, and I'm forgetting it right now. That's bad.
So a scientist funded by BP said, eventually, the bugs are going to eat the oil.
I mean, he said initially that they've eaten most of it, and that they've eaten most of it. I'm not positive that he said they're going to continue eating, but he definitely said they've eaten most of it.
Now, what happens to oil that bonds, if it does bond, what happens to oil that Corexit is applied to? Because as most people know who are listening to this program, they know that the Gulf was sprayed. My friend has a great phrase, in my conspiranoia reality that I live in, my friend said that they sprayed the Corexit on there to get the oil out of the way so that the media couldn't see it. That was probably my greatest disappointment in Obama, that he allowed them to not have the press come and photograph and videotape and report honestly what happened, that all the press had to stay away from the site. I thought that was the most disgraceful thing that Obama ever did in his administration.
I mean, I was regularly, threatened by police for trying to go to beaches to cover spill sites. People who wanted to volunteer to take us out in boats were told that they would be fined $60,000 for doing so and be sent to jail. Fortunately, some people were so concerned with getting the truth out that they still brought myself and other journalists out into the water.
You don't know.
I don't know. Hopefully not the ones that were kind enough to help me. And people, were paid. So it was, they were desperate for income, and they were risking, a dollar in the hand for the threat of a $60,000 fine because they were desperate and needed it. But, the obstacles were great in trying to cover this story.
So what happens to the Corexit applied to the oil?
So 2 million gallons of Corexit are applied. So part of the story here—
A dispersant.
It's a chemical dispersant. Part of the story is that the only thing that BP had prepared for and that actually any oil company operating in the Gulf had prepared for was oil on the surface of the ocean. And it's very common to apply a little bit of Corexit to a little bit of oil on the surface. The idea is that you do want to break it up because you don't want animals to get caught in it. You also don't want it floating to shore. Oil is toxic. You don't want humans coming into contact with it. And the idea is that, you apply a little at the top, and it's some harm to the water, but it's worth it. But this was a totally unprecedented oil spill in size and scope and depth. And for the first time ever, the Corexit, because they'd only planned for something at the top, not expecting a 3-month-long oil spill, although they should have.
They paid the whole site with Corexit, basically.
They applied it at the bottom of the ocean.
Oh.
So they sprayed it at the site of the spill. So you had this huge cocktail, toxic cocktail, of the toxic Corexit combined with the toxic oil. And what studies have found is that, in fact, the combination of the two is at least 50% more toxic than either alone. And the only thing that the Corexit is supposed to do is disperse. That's all it's even meant to do. So what you're choosing to do—
Who manufactures Corexit, do you know? As your research—
Norelco manufactures Corexit, yeah. And they, for a very long time, refused to release all of the chemical components of Corexit, and they also refused to—
Have they since?
I think they have since. And they also refused to make it available to scientists to do their own research on to be able to study the impacts, and I believe that has also since ended. But what they did was basically intentionally sacrifice the ocean in an attempt to protect the shore. But of course, they failed at both because they also hadn't prepared to protect the shore. So not only did they apply all of this chemical to the ocean, but the oil also did, of course, make its way to the shore, as did now the chemically infused, Corexit-infused oil make it to shore.
Now, when you talk about Corexit, you said that oil is leaking into the Gulf as a matter of course constantly. And the system has survived, and even at its most, I don't want to say pristine, but at its most natural, at its least impacted, there's still some oil coming out of the bottom of the Gulf because there's oil all over the Gulf, and that just is how the ecosystem operates and exists. But Corexit is not something that comes out of the ground. Corexit is a toxic chemical that's applied. Now, 2 million gallons of this substance poured into the Gulf of Mexico on top of that site is I'm going to guess that's spit in the ocean in terms of how it breaks down into the body of water. But has there been any research done to determine what Corexit itself has done to wildlife and to the—
So
is that 2-inch layer there? Because you said that they commingled the Corexit with it at the site.
Yeah.
They shot it into the stream of oil at the site, correct?
That's right.
At the wellhead.
That's right.
And when they did that, is that layer of oil on the ground, is that bonded with Corexit? Has anybody done any tests about that?
Yeah, there is Corexit. Corexit and the oil have both stayed and are likely to stay forever because the bottom of the ocean is a dark, cold place. Yeah. It's like the best freezer in the world. And so
it's not going anywhere.
It's not going anywhere. But also, what's left of the oil, essentially, so there are microbes that have developed over millennia that have feasted on this. And just to make this clear, very teeny, teeny, tiny amount of naturally releasing oil that comes out of the Gulf of Mexico in very, very small amounts. And over millennia, communities have developed around this oil, and they have thrived because it's small and it's a natural occurrence, and there's time for the species to commingle with the oil. So there are these naturally occurring microbes that do eat the oil, but they ate as much as they could, and it was only a small amount, but also they only ate what they could. So what they left behind is also the most toxic parts of the oil. It's what they didn't want to eat, and these are called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are the most toxic part of the oil, carcinogens known to be cancer-causing in humans.
This is the stuff that's at the bottom.
This is what's at the bottom with the Corexit.
Wait, so the Corexit's down there as well.
As well.
Now, how would you characterize BP's response to this, what you've observed?
Well,
initially and down the road.
We know now through the court case that BP, first of all, lied when it said that it was prepared for a blowout, for a deepwater blowout. It actually had said in its exploration plan to drill that it could handle a blowout almost three times as large as the oil spill that actually ended up happening. And it was, in fact, totally unprepared. It also then lied about how much oil was being released every day from the oil well. It also had said that it could handle the oil spill, which also implies that it could stop the oil spill. But it turns out that the only method that it had available for stopping the oil spill, it and every other oil company, by the way, operating in the Gulf of Mexico, was the only thing they already knew how to do, which is also the most dangerous thing, which is drill another well. It took 152 days to drill another well. That's the only thing that permanently stopped the well.
To pour the sand in?
First, they did the thing where they tried the top hat, which was throwing, I mean, we saw this on jokes made about it on TV because it was laughable. It's things that work in shallow water, 400 feet. This was 5,000 feet. So throwing golf balls and rubber from tires onto it.
What should they have done? Where have you seen examples of this going? Obviously not to that level because the Deepwater Horizon is an anomaly, I'm assuming, correct, in terms of scope?
Yes.
But where you've seen these kinds of things, where have you seen something effective that's worked? That's not golf balls. I mean, what do they do?
So what's come out since is that there is another temporary method that they should have known about and should have had ready, they and every other company. Again, this isn't just BP. So I went into this story thinking—
So BP is a company that really, they were the unlucky ones. It could have happened to any of them.
It could and still could.
Yeah, exactly. But I want to get back to this thing, which is where have you seen this? Because it's one thing to say— there's something that they should have known after the fact. But at the time that it happened, what information did they have? Because I want to be fair to them as well. At the time that it happened, what information did they have where you've seen other people do this better?
That someone's done it better, there isn't an example. What they all did know, however, there are very clear examples. So what they all knew, all the companies knew, was that the thing that they're depending on the most, which is something called the blowout preventer, which is the huge piece of equipment that sits on top of a well that's supposed to, when there is a blowout, prevent it by shutting in the well. So it's called the blowout preventer. That these pieces of equipment only had about a 50% success rate. This is the last line of defense. They also should have, and this is something that is just them, they should have had it running as properly as it could have. So one of the things we also know is that they had allowed the batteries on the blowout preventer to run out. Literally, it had old batteries.
Does that affect them in court? Did they pay for that in court?
So
they didn't get their hands chopped off for that?
They were. So I guess there's three pieces of the litigation. The first, BP was found grossly negligent and definitely got in trouble by the judge for, in the judge's words, putting profits above everything else. And that was in what led to the blowout. So BP made decision after decision after decision on the rig. And I guess in this circumstance, yes, there are things that other companies have done better that they could have done better, where they were trying to save time, trying to save money, and just making very, very, very poor decisions time and time again that contributed, that made the blowout happen. And so for that, the judge found them grossly negligent. But everything that came after, meaning their inability to stop the blowout, their inability to clean it up, their decision to apply 2 million gallons of Corexit, their inability to keep it from hitting the shore and killing 100,000 animals, for that, the judge said, no other company knows how to do it any better than you did, which means not at all. And the government didn't require you to do it any better. So you and everybody else gets a pass on everything that came after. The judge said that. So where we're now coming to is the third phase of trial, where the judge is now going to say how much BP owes, and it could be as much as almost $14 billion for all of the oil that was released into the Gulf of Mexico. But it could be as little as $140,000. So that's why this low end is very important, and that's why the fact that it's important that the judge said that BP made very poor decisions, including allowing the blowout preventer to run out of batteries, that it was grossly negligent for doing that, and as well as Halliburton and Transocean were also found negligent for their parts, you know, two of the largest companies in the world.
How much was Halliburton fined?
Halliburton, I'm not positive.
They were fined something, correct?
I think they reached a settlement, BP. But okay. I'm not positive.
They settled.
Yeah, okay. I'm not positive where they're at with okay. their case. I'm pretty sure they settled.
Now, you studied these companies for quite a while now.
Yeah.
You've covered this industry for 15 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
You're at the bottom of you're in the submersible
mm-hmm.
and all of the fears of that aside and everything. But with your knowledge of what's going on and why and what isn't happening and why, and you're with this woman who's this colleague of yours, this revered colleague
mm-hmm.
from the University of Georgia, Dr. Joy. And what did you think when you were down? Did that upset you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say certainly.
Are you completely cynical about it, or does any of it really upset you?
Oh, it always upsets me. I mean, I can't tell you every day there's something new that I learn about this disaster that still continues to depress me and shock me. And when I was down there, I was unbelievably depressing. You know, I looked out of the window. I was at the bottom of the ocean. It was incredible. Unthinkable opportunity. And it's basically a virtual dead zone. And not only are we down there and there's lots of time to reflect, but suddenly we see tracks in the ground, which are parallel, which means that they're clearly man-made. And that signals that not only is there this dead zone, but somebody's laying cable down there, which means that I later come to learn they're getting ready to drill again in the exact same area. So the federal government has divided up this lease area, sold it to another company called LLOG without any public awareness or debate. LLOG gets basically almost the entire lease and the rights to produce oil off of it. And they are now and people aren't also paying attention because instead of going in the exact same spot so you could see a rig, they're over an adjacent lease area, drilling from the adjacent lease area and then cutting horizontally under the ground into the original area. And this all they wrote a plan. It took less than a month for the Department of Interior to okay the plan. It looks remarkably and depressingly similar to the same plan that BP had drawn up originally, and everything is just literally back to business as usual.
What hope do you think there is for accelerating renewable production in this country?
Well, I mean, first of all, the U.S. government subsidizes the oil industry to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars every year.
Take that
so
money.
There's lots of money there. Yeah. They don't need it. They're the wealthiest industry the world has ever known. We can take those subsidies. Those can be applied to alternative energy. We can also, I think it absolutely is something that can be done and should be done at the local level. So if we look at local consumption, reducing local consumption of energy and providing energy at the local level, I think you'll also come up with more potential resources made available and partnering with government, with federal government resources. But there's a lot of money out there that can be successfully cut out of the budget that's being used to subsidize and support the fossil fuel industry that I think almost everyone would agree is unnecessary. And that money, at a minimum, can be directed to alternative energy.
The government is still
it has a role.
The key player.
Not the only player, but it has a role. Okay. It certainly has a role to play.
Antonia Juhas's article on the repercussions of BP's oil spill is in the June issue of Harper's Magazine. Lately, Juhas has been following the protests surrounding the Polar Pioneer, Shell's giant offshore oil rig, for Rolling Stone. I called Antonia up to learn the latest.
We wanted to add a comment from you about two events that I've been tracking recently, which I'm obviously plain to you. And the first one is the Santa Barbara spill. When I was reading that story and following that story, it led us to corrosion in the infrastructure of those pipes. And I'm wondering, is that something that's pretty common now? Should we expect this to happen more often, or is there the possibility? Is Santa Barbara an isolated incident or no?
No, Santa Barbara isn't isolated for a number of reasons. The first being that corrosive old pipes is actually a huge problem throughout our oil and gas system. There are spills related to problems with pipelines, pipeline ruptures, including corrosion that happen all over the United States all the time. And in fact, in 2014, there were more of those spills than at any time in at least the last 20 years. And that's partly because we're moving more product through the pipes, but also because the pipes are, you know, just get older every year. And, you know, disasters like what happened in Santa Barbara are actually, unfortunately, quite common.
I remember when I first went to Santa Barbara to visit from L.A. I was living in L.A. many, many years ago, and I went up there to check it out. And when I was staying at one specific hotel, they had cleaning solvent and they had cloths that you used to take the tar balls off your and the oil blobs off your feet, because a lot of that stuff washed up periodically on the beaches. It was a very common occurrence. It was very regular. Now, was that area still as busy and is still as productive an oil field off the coast of California there? Is that still humming the way it has been for many decades now?
Yeah, there's, you know, a lot of oil and gas off the shores of California in general, but Santa Barbara in particular. That area is actually the birthplace of offshore oil drilling in the United States going back to the late 1800s. But oil spills are also, unfortunately, common, and actually one of the largest offshore oil disasters in the United States before the Deepwater Horizon happened in 2010 happened in 1969 in Santa Barbara, and that was a huge offshore blowout that led to 3 million gallons of oil spilled and led to a movement to put in place moratoriums against offshore oil drilling, first in the waters right off Santa Barbara, but then the moratorium spread and they affected almost everywhere except for the U.S. Gulf of Mexico and parts of Alaska where drilling was allowed to continue. But the existing offshore operations off California were grandfathered in. So there still are these platforms that we see when you're in Santa Barbara. And it's actually from one of those old grandfathered in platforms, actually two of them, one from ExxonMobil and another operated by a much smaller company called Venoco, that this oil spill actually happened because the oil is piped into shore through subsea pipelines. Then once it gets to shore, it's put into a processing facility. Then it travels along this onshore pipeline. And it was along the onshore leg that the rupture happened. Right. The oil then spilled onto the beach and into the ocean.
When you mention Alaska, the next question becomes your thoughts about Obama permitting drilling in, and I want you to name the region more specifically up in the Arctic, where, what is the area, describe for us what is the area where, in the sea, where Obama has now said they can have underwater drilling?
Yeah, well now, in the Chukchi Sea, which is off of Alaska in the Arctic, a part of Alaska that's heavily inhabited by indigenous populations and a broad diversity of wildlife, including polar bears and walruses and hundreds of different bird and fish species.
And also describe, if you would, the conditions of the water in the dead of winter there.
It's freezing water. Huge blocks of ice are primarily what you find here in the winter. Not really water per se, but rather, you know, ice sheets. Mm-hmm. And they're supposed to be solid. Of course, global warming is making that less common. But that's why when Obama opened this area to offshore drilling, what that meant, what's supposed to mean, is that the only time that the companies can drill is a very small window when there's actually, you know, open water there for them to drill in. So that's the summer months, and going only as late as October is their only opportunity for when they are allowed to drill, because it is such a cold, frozen, harsh, really unprecedented type of environment to try to engage in offshore oil drilling in.
But I also read somewhere that it's very rough seas up there in the wintertime, correct?
That's right.
Very rough water.
Yeah, exactly. Rough water.
Very deep.
Distances between where, you know, the Coast Guard is stationed, where there are pockets of, you know, land and places where people are,
where emergency services might come from, where help might come from, right? What do you think it was, if you can say, that prompted Obama to make that ruling?
Shell is the largest oil company in the world. It's the oil company that's had leases in this area for a very long time, and it's been trying to develop this area for a very long time. And the reason why it hasn't is because its operations keep running into problems. It keeps trying and failing. And, you know, the Obama administration is still engaged in this incredibly dangerous, what it calls the all of the above energy strategy, which is a, you know, I believe a really false belief that you can simultaneously support alternatives and biofuels and, you know, clean energy advancements and regulation at the same time as allowing the industry to go anywhere and everywhere it wants all of the time. And, you know, don't take my word for it now, take the Pope's word for it, that, you know, we really can't follow both of those paths at the same time and keep the planet inhabitable for our species. But, you know, there's a lot of money in the oil industry. And I, you know, think that the political influence there is ultimately what, you know, wins out.
Antonia, thank you so much for taking my phone call. And again, thank you for being a part of our broadcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.